Hello, kids. This is Harry Slash. You might remember me from such hits as This Is Extreme, This Is Extreme 2, This Is Extreme Y2K, This Is Extreme the Disco Remix, This Is Extreme 4 the Pioneer Version, This Is Extreme 5 the Acoustic Version, This Is Extreme 17 the Dixieland Band Version. Actually, no, this is just Harry Slash of the Slash Tones, and you're listening to the This Is Extreme podcast with Dave Dynasty.
Beat me if you can, survive if I let you.
Procuring nevermore.
Let the new era begin, the era of the ECW.
Oh my god.
Greetings, ECW fans, and welcome to This Is Extreme, the ECW History Podcast. I am your host, Dave Dynasty. Thank you for joining us on whatever podcast platform you choose. In whichever platform you prefer, make sure you subscribe to us there. And if possible, if it's an option, give us a rating and review. That helps us in those algorithms. When people are listening to similar podcasts, we come up as a suggested listen. We got a couple things to discuss. Real quick, before we dive into the interview for this week, a couple of newsworthy things here. We just recently had an interview with Sal from Rush Collectibles, and it seems like no sooner than we had that, we talked to him about those figures. The Extreme Ringmasters line from Rush Collectibles has been canceled. I was afraid of this. Lots of people were afraid of this. I was hopeful. I was trying to be positive, have a great mindset on this, and talk to Sal and see where it was, and because this is something that I really, really wanted. But lo and behold, it is not to be. So those figures are not coming. So we can all, you know, be sad and wallow in our sorrow. Coming up on Thanksgiving weekend, which will be right as you're hearing this, at the WrestleCade show in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, at the Benton Convention Center, Shane Douglas will be having, on Friday, November 24th, a 40 Years of the Franchise, a Hardcore Legacy. It is Shane Douglas, hosted by Brian Reznor. It's from 4 p.m. to 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time. General admission is $10. VIP tickets, $25. Go hear Shane talk about his career. I'm sure there'll be lots of cool things to hear with that. So if you're in that area and have the opportunity, or if you're already planning to go to WrestleCade, make sure you check out Shane on that panel that he does. On today's episode, we have a really, really, really great interview. We have Harry Slash, the ECW music guru. We talk all kinds of things because Harry had a little bit of a going on in everything, right? He had a little hand in the production, a little hand in doing this and that. Had a lot of influence and input and creative and development in the music side of ECW. And we talk about all that. And Harry has a ton of stories. And we just hit the tip of the iceberg, and we'll have him back on again in the future. So it is a great, great interview. And man, I can't wait for you to hear it. So let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll have that interview with Harry Slash. So stick around.
Be sure to follow This Is Extreme on all social media platforms. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for ECW Pod. Be sure to follow us, keep up to date, and join in the discussions. We want to hear your feedback, so find us on all the social media platforms and join the revolution.
All right, and welcome back to This Is Extreme. And I'm now being joined by the ECW music guru, Harry Slash. Harry, how are you?
Thank you. I just want to give your audience a heads up. I'm not 120 years old. I have a mouthful of stitches from dental surgery, so it's a little difficult to talk. So every so often, if I sound like, you know, I don't have any teeth, it's because I don't. I just have stitches right now.
Yeah. Yeah, we were gonna record a week or so ago or something, and you had just had surgery and couldn't talk. So
the day we were supposed to record, I had to go back for emergency surgery. One of the most painful experiences of my life, because a botched root canal, not by the dentist, not by the dentist that's working on me now, but by the idiot that I let work on me before. He had pierced the root during a root canal.
Man, that's horrible.
It caused such a massive infection, I had to be gigged on the inside of my mouth without Novocaine to drain.
Oh, that's the man. Yeah.
But let's not talk about painful stuff.
That's nah. at least, you know, not your wrestling painful stuff, maybe. We'll see what that leads to. But yeah, I'm glad you're on. You're one of the guys that when I started this podcast, I wanted to make sure I got on. And I'm excited to talk to you. And obviously, first and foremost, you're a musician. So how did you develop your interest in music and start playing?
My interest in music started when I was maybe like 4 or 5 years old. Before I was born, my father's job was to service the rotation of 45s. For you younger audiences, that's vinyl singles that contained music, something you can actually hold in your hands. But he serviced the jukeboxes all over New York. And my father was a hoarder, and most people that did that job, when the single would go out of rotation, they would throw it in the garbage. My father would bring those things home.
Yeah.
So by the time I got my first record player, I think I was like 4 or 5 years old, something like that. The little one piece where the lid opens up, and that's the speakers in the lid. It's every little kid born before the year 1980 had one of those things. So in my garage, I had like 1,000 vinyl 45s. So I would just go down into the garage and grab a stack, and it would be everything from Louis Armstrong to Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
And I just started listening to like this diverse variety of music, like, you know, stuff you wouldn't expect a child to be listening to. But I would, you know, my schoolmates were listening to Sesame Street records, I was grooving to Jimmy Durante and Louis Armstrong and early Beatles and, you know, all the whole British invasion stuff and a lot of jazz and blues stuff, you know, as far as contemporary, a ton of Irish music, a ton of Greek music, Israeli music, Arabic music, because he serviced jukeboxes in all different locations.
Yeah.
So that's where the love of music came in, was just having that huge diversity in the days before streaming and Spotify at my disposal inside my garage.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a huge music fan too. That's kind of the same with me. My dad had a huge vinyl collection, and I would just go out when I was little and I would just pick out albums based on what I thought were the cool album covers. Yeah. And that's what I'd listen to. So I, obviously one of the big ones that hit me early on was Zeppelin, because their album covers were so cool. And you know, when I hit elementary school, middle school, I thought everybody was listening to this stuff, and I didn't understand why people weren't listening to more, you know, 60s rock and folk. And I had a very different view on music than most of my peers.
I'm glad you brought up Led Zeppelin. I think I was 5 or 6 years old, and I went to a record store with my older cousins. They wanted to buy, I guess, the latest pop hair band, you know, Beatles crap, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I had a fascination with the footage of the Hindenburg explosion, which used to be shown on PBS all the time.
Yeah.
I don't know why I had such a fascination of a disaster as a kid, but I see the Hindenburg on an album cover.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'm thinking that it's just an audio transcription of the footage that I'd watched. So I plunked down the $4 of my birthday money, or however much a vinyl LP costs. And I came home and I opened up my plastic turntable, and I expected to hear the news reporter. It's like, oh, the humanity. And instead I'm listening to Good Times, Bad Times, Dazed and Confused. And I'm like, I don't know what this shit is, but I like it.
Yeah. Yeah, that man, Zeppelin 1's still my favorite Zeppelin album. Because, man, I'm a huge blues guy, and there's just such a huge blues infusion on that first album. Well, the first couple, but particularly that first one. People always talk about 4 and this and that, but man, that first one just, it gets me every time.
Well, the first one was basically continuing what the Yardbirds
had. Right. Yep. Yep.
Okay. The amazing thing about Zeppelin 1, I think it was recorded in like 36 hours.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like ridiculously quickly in the studio. And 50 plus years later, it's flawless. You can put it on today and it sounds as fresh as it did, you know, when it came out.
Absolutely. It's wild, all those guys, man. The stuff, like, I'll be, you know, stuff that I'm assuming, you know, I played guitar and I played some garage bands when I was in high school, but nothing severe, nothing major. But I imagine some of the technology that's available to guys now. And then, you know, you're talking in the 60s and whatever, these guys were developing it. They had to invent their own stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, you talk about, you know, Hendrix inventing the wall pedal and different things, you know, effects pedals, because it didn't exist. So he had, well, what he wanted to get, he had to make it. So that's always wild to me.
The Beatles, while not my favorite band, you know, I really liked the Beatles after they started dropping acid.
Yeah.
And recording their psychedelic stuff. But their earlier stuff to me is just, it's a boy band.
Yeah, yeah, just,
you know that Can't Buy Me Love, 8 days a week, all that great music, not my cup of tea. But then they started smoking pot and dropping acid
and experimenting, right? Yeah,
those are the albums I enjoyed. Granted, they were before my time. I discovered them after the fact, but still, reading up on how they would invent technology,
yeah,
like take the reel tape and flip it upside down and backwards, yep. And do all sorts of crazy shit that was unheard of in the studio.
Yep.
And now their recent Now and Then, the release, is just following up on their innovation of technology, where it took 20 years until Peter Jackson created the technology to be able to separate John Lennon's voice on the cassette from the piano.
Yep.
And, you know, everybody's making a big deal of the last Beatles song. When I first heard it, I said, who cares? But then I really listened to it a couple more times, and I'm like, this is pretty brilliant.
Yeah, I agree. And it's the song's okay, but it's the whole process is fascinating to me. How they can that's what amazes me.
The song is a five, but the technology and the process of creating it is a 10.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's it's crazy to me. It's like, I don't know. Even, you know, even if you're not the big, you know, biggest Beatles fan, you just got to get moved by, right? These guys, this was their life for so many years. Yeah. And, you know, for Paul and Ringo to go in and work with something like this and have a part in it, man, it's got to be moving to them, right? It's got to be, you know, heavy to them. And it's pretty wild.
There's a great 11-minute documentary on the creation of that song.
Yeah.
Where, you know, they George Harrison had recorded parts for it and Ringo recorded parts for it back in 96, but they couldn't separate John Lennon's vocals. So the thing sat on the shelf until the technology was invented. But since then, George Harrison passed away. However, they kept his tracks from the 94 sessions, and then Paul McCartney embellished them with slide guitar, and he played a new bass line, and Ringo played a new drums. And they had George Martin's son create the string sections, which really does make it a bona fide Beatles song.
Yep, I agree. Yeah, it's pretty. It's again, like you said, like if it's not, even if it's not your cup of tea, it's still magical, right? There's still a magic to it. It's pretty crazy.
And I don't think ECW ever used a single Beatles song. Just throwing that out there.
Yeah, probably not. I wouldn't imagine what it would be.
No.
I don't know. I mean, even though they had the Blue Meanie, right? I mean, he didn't use a Beatles song, but right, it's a little bit of an inspired Beatles character, right, from Yellow Submarine. So
yeah, but that's just a parody, you know.
That's a parody. It's correct. Yeah.
Same way they got away with doing what they did with the BWO, and legally WCW couldn't do nothing about it because of the beauty of the First Amendment protecting a parody.
That's right. Yeah, the BWO did all. I mean, they were built on parodies, right? I mean, they were parodying everything in those early. Some of those early things. I mean, I always remember them coming out and doing the Kiss thing. And
they also did Baron von Raschke.
Stephen
Rabel. The BWO wasn't meant to last. It was much like the Kiss thing. It was only supposed to be a spot thing, and it blew up. You know, and 25 years later, those guys are still doing the BWO thing at autograph signings, and rightfully so. It was a brilliant parody that took on a life of its own, It also gave a platform to turn Stevie Richards from being a second banana goof to being a credible competitor.
Yep. Yeah, and I think that's part of the magic of ECW, right? Everybody always talks with ECW, right? They always talk. It's violent, right? It's blood and chair shots and barbed wire. And man, it was such a mix. There was so much stuff in ECW, right? There was the hardcore, the violent stuff. But then you had some of that parody comedy stuff with the BWO, and you had, you know, the scientific stuff, and you had the lucha stuff, and it was such a hybrid mix of just a little bit of everything.
Shane Douglas said it the best: a good circus gives you a variety. You know, okay, so you don't like the clowns, you might like the jugglers. You don't like the jugglers, you might like the high wire act. You don't like the high wire act, you'd enjoy the magicians. You know, it'll give you a little something. You may not enjoy every single aspect of the show, but there is stuff you will enjoy. There were a lot of ECW fans, they just want the blood and guts.
Yep.
You know, but then again, you get something like Too Cold Scorpio versus Dean Malenko, and matches like Guerrero and Malenko and all those guys doing the highly technical matches, and bringing in Jerry Lynn, who didn't do barbed wire matches. And those are enjoyable too.
Yep.
You know, a little mix of everything, and a lot of sexism using women as props, which you can't do today.
No, there's definitely plenty of that.
Yeah.
So let's talk about you. You met, you got into wrestling through Paul Heyman, right? Who you met in New York kind of through the music stuff, right? Through the club scene. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I wasn't watching wrestling when I met Paul. I didn't know what a Paulie Dangerously was. And I met him at the China Club and we became friends, but I really didn't know what he did for a living, nor did I bother to ask. However, the way other people treated him and kissed his ass and gave him drink tickets, I figured he was either a mafia guy, a restaurant owner, a drug dealer, a pornographer. And other than owning a restaurant, he turned out to be a little bit of everything.
That is so definitely true.
I eventually found out what he did for a living by mistake. They were doing a party for him at a club called Octagon, where part of the event for the night, along with a jam session and a fashion show and all that other garbage, was the presentation of the Manager of the Year award to Paulie Dangerously. So I went to Octagon that night. I went up to the VIP room, and there's my friend Paul, but he's not wearing blue jeans and cowboy boots and a leather jacket. He's in a suit. He comes up and he goes, "What are you doing here?" And I'm like, "Well, most of my friends are in the jam band and they're doing some stupid wrestling shit I want to check out." An hour later, I go back up to the VIP room. They've set up a 6-foot projection screen showing the best of Paulie Dangerously. And I look at the screen, and then I look at my friend in the suit with this big Cheshire Cat smile on his face. And I look back at the screen. I look back at my friend. And for a moment, I thought Paul was just one of those cosplay idiots that dresses up like wrestlers. It just didn't dawn on me that that's what he was. So he puts his arm around my shoulders like, "So who is that handsome guy on the screen?" And I'm like, "That's what you do for a living, man? Yeah, all right. That's cool."
That's funny. So I assume then you started going to ECW shows because I guess Paul invited you, right?
Yeah, but I avoided them like the plague. Okay. Yep. For me, when Bruno Sammartino permed his hair, put on a yellow jacket, for me, wrestling was over.
Yeah.
Plus, at one point, all wrestling had gone off of broadcast television and onto cable.
Yeah.
And where I lived in New York, in Queens was the last borough to get cable because of some dispute between Time Warner and Direct, or whatever the two companies were that were battling over the Queens territory that entire time. So wrestling was no longer on my radar. And when I found out what he did for a living, he started inviting me to go out to Philadelphia to the shows at the arena. Yeah. I really didn't want to watch wrestling at that point. I had watched a lot of the Saturday night's main event, which was on WNBC, which was broadcast.
Yeah.
And what I did see, I didn't really care for. I wasn't into the cartoons. You know, the wrestling I grew up with was a guy coming out with a first name and a last name and blue trunks, and he would put on a headlock and it would be an illusion of competition, because when I was watching it, we still believed it was real, that it was a competitive sport, you know, and we would accept the goofy things like wrestlers wearing masks to hide their true identity. So it could be believable.
Yeah. You know,
so Paul starts inviting me to go out to the arena. And at the time, I had a Ford Bronco that had 300,000 miles on it, which was a great excuse to not go. I'm like, oh, my car would never make it. My car will never make it. He calls me up on a Thursday night and goes, I have a show tomorrow I'd like you to go to. I'm like, dude, my car won't make it to Pennsylvania. He goes, the show's on Queens Boulevard at the Lost Battalion Hall. It is 15 minutes from your house. If your car can't go 15 minutes, I will send a taxi to pick you up. So I'm like, all right, I'll come see your show. What time does it start? And he goes, it's from 8 to 11. So I showed up at 10:45. Okay, just to make that appearance, you know.
Yeah.
He saw me. It's like, what'd you think of the show? And I'm like, well, from the 5 minutes I saw, I thought it was cool. You know, I don't remember what the match was in the ring, but he brings me backstage and he immediately introduces me to Mick Foley, because he figured me and Mick would get along because of the music connection, the Leonard Cohen thing. And he introduces me to Sabu. First two people that I met in ECW was Sabu and Foley. And he asked me to if I could get Sabu high. I used to have this little device called a protopipe, where you could, it would be you would have the pot ground up in a chamber and you could pour it in the bowl and pack it in there. And it was like this beautiful little single, you know, this little pipe that had everything there other than the lighter. So he's like, can you do me a favor? Can you get Sabu high? So we go out to one of the corridors in the Lost Battalion Hall. And I look at him and say, my name's Harry. What's your name? He goes, Sabu. I'm like, what's your real name? He goes, Sabu. Sabu. And I'm looking at the genie pants and I'm like, oh, like Sabu. I knew the movie Sabu the Elephant Boy.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is where his uncle got the name from. So yep. When he goes Sabu the second time, I'm like, oh, like the Elephant Boy? He goes, fuck you. And I'm like, I like this guy. He's a prick. I'm going to get along with this guy. So I got high with Sabu, and then I avoided every other show at the Lost Battalion Hall. I avoided until 10:45, and I finally went to a show at like 8 o'clock. And I'm like, this is insane. This is like a giant mosh pit of a car crash of humanity and violence and complete chaos. This is not a guy dressed up like a turkey. I like this. I could get into this.
Yeah.
So then I started attending more shows as a fan, still just in the audience. And then one show upstate New York in Middletown, I think it was, they were short on security. And they asked if I could help out. I had the background of, you know, the club world. I wasn't a security dude in the clubs. I was a club promoter and a booker.
Yeah.
But I could handle myself. And if anything ever happened, a fight happened, I would be one of the first ones to jump in. So I'm like, what do you guys need me to do? And they're like, the wrestlers are going to wrestle through the crowd. Make sure nobody hurts them. And my first question is, does that mean I could hurt the fans? Like, we'd prefer it if you didn't, but if you have to, go ahead. So that was my first forte into doing anything, was volunteer security at one show in Middletown.
Yeah.
And then as time progressed, Heyman would get me to do other stuff during the week, you know, backstage stuff, you know, get ads into the Daily News and look up some logistics shit for him and what have you. And the next thing I know, I'm doing stuff for ECW almost part-time at that point. And then I started attending the monthly arena shows and the TV tapings. And the next thing I know, I've been drafted into doing live production, because I also had a background of that from when I did theater. I worked in theater for a number of years doing lighting, sound, staging, other shit.
Yeah.
So I became one of the many all-around guys that Heyman had around, doing a little bit of everything.
Yeah. Do you think, you know, coming from a music background, that maybe you could appreciate ECW in a different way, not only as athletic, but maybe the artistic side with the gear, the music, the presentation? Do you think maybe you could see, yeah, you could see the different angles of it?
Absolutely. The choice of music, because when I first started doing the production stuff, it was still all commercial music he was using.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there was no original music to be had. And I like the fact that using real music that you would hear on the radio as opposed to like pre-recorded two-chord, one-part nonsense that
yeah.
the other companies were using actually gave the project, the product, more of a realistic feel.
Yep.
You know, plus there are certain things like Sandman, you know, owes his career to Metallica.
Yeah.
You know, when he was already using Enter Sandman when I went first time I went to ECW. But when I saw some of the earlier stuff, when he was coming out to like Surfing USA and Pat Benatar, so I'm like, what is this shit?
Yeah.
You know, but the music helped the characters to develop their unique identity. And in some cases, the music became synonymous with the character's identity.
Yeah, it's wild because, like you mentioned, Sandman. No one remembers any great Sandman matches, but they remember great Sandman entrances.
That's, yeah. You know, that. Well, that's when you don't need to do much.
Yeah.
You know, the people wanted to sing the song, hopefully get beer splashed on them, you know, and
yeah,
the entrances were great. The one night stand entrance was great. His return to the arena with the loudest pop ever.
Yep.
Was phenomenal. It was my job that night to get him from his van to the ladder. He did not step foot in the dressing room the night he returned. He didn't let anybody know he was there. When it was time to go get him, he even put a towel over his head and had the kendo stick inside of a bag. And he walked through the dressing room with the towel over his head. He kayfabed the entire locker room. I got him to the ladder. You know, I had a little mag light so we could see where we were going. I got him to the ladder. When that spotlight came on, I actually felt the vibrations and the rush of wind of the entire audience taking one step forward in that direction. And it was numbing. Like, I'd never experienced anything like that. It felt like a mini earthquake right at that spot because everybody's voice and was headed in that direction. They were all shouting in that direction where Sandman was. And I felt it from behind the bleachers at the foot of the ladder. And I'm like, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I always thought ECW had a very punk rock vibe, right? Because of the crowd, the vibe, DIY, you know, everything about it was just, it had that same feel about it, right? Because everybody was pitching in, doing a little bit of whatever it took in the self-promotion and the making their own merchandise and everything else. ECW was, to me, the most rock and roll wrestling's ever been.
It was, punk rock is a great way to put it because there was no budget.
Right, yeah.
It's not like he had a staff of hundreds. Like Dreamer said, I think in the one night, the WWE documentary, that he was in charge of the merchandise warehouse, and it would be him, Guido, and Devon would be literally, you'd order your shirts, and they'd be packing it up, and Stevie Richards ran the ticket booth and the ticket office in Philadelphia, and Bubba Ray was the promoter for Queens, and Shane was the promoter for Pittsburgh. And a lot of guys had their own little territory where they would promote. They'd get a small piece of the gate. But everybody basically did it just to see the company succeed.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the magic, right? Because it's that mom-and-pop family-owned business feel. Everybody was invested. Everybody did their part. And because they weren't just going out there, doing a 20-minute match and then going home, everybody was doing all this different stuff. I think there was a lot.
Well,
right. But I mean, several guys. I just think everybody was so invested in the company that it gave it that close-knit feel you always hear that ECW had.
At one point, Taz ran the school,
mm-hmm.
and he also designed a lot of the T-shirts.
Yeah, right.
Okay, that was him. I forget what program he was using. It was whatever existed before Photoshop.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he would be designing a lot of the shirts, and then somebody else, I forget who, was in charge of getting them manufactured, and then they would end up in the merchandise office up in Westchester.
Yeah.
And it would be Dreamer and Guido and Devon, and somebody else would be taking the orders and packing them in the boxes and getting them to the post office. You know, there was a lot of mom and pop thing, like you said, because it was kind of like the Little Rascals when they would put on a show. One guy had a barn, they would all paint the scenery. Spanky would take the tickets and be the star of the show and all of that. That was ECW.
Yeah, so, go ahead.
If it had a budget for, like if we had AEW money,
no.
I don't think ECW would have been as good.
No, probably not.
It was part of that whole underground thing where we had to steal barbed wire and helmets.
Yep.
You know, that first pay-per-view, Heyman, you know, asked on a Sunday, where can we get police riot gear on a Sunday? I'm like, everybody's like, dude, yesterday all the stores were open. So the late Debbie Beaumont has Craig Hasbrook and myself basically drove around Philadelphia, and if there was a motorcycle helmet on a motorcycle, we would just steal it. So if you were in Philadelphia, if you were in Philadelphia on April 13th of 97 and you came out of a bar and your motorcycle helmet was missing, hey, sorry, dude, you should have brought it in.
Yeah, it could have been a famous helmet, though. It made a pay-per-view debut.
the last pay-per-view for the CW Anderson Tommy Dreamer I Quit match.
Yeah.
The ring crew had to climb the ladder of the building next door to the Hammerstein and cut down the barbed wire because we didn't have any. It was all done with smoke and mirrors. You know, Paul would say, you know, well, we don't have a big budget for lighting and for pyro, so let's emphasize the athleticism. And eventually ECW did get more of a budget where they brought in an actual lighting company.
Yeah.
You know, but even the lighting company, I think that was BML, they were told to do it minimal to make it look like patchwork jobs. You know, they had a broken Lico, broken Fresnel, and Paul said, no, leave it hanging. It looks good with the duct tape. You know, he liked that whole raw, gritty feel. And it added to it.
Yeah. Yeah, you mentioned that first pay-per-view, Barely Legal. So that night, what all were you up to? What all were you doing on that night? I'm a little bit of everything, I imagine. You were probably running around like everybody else.
Oh, God. I have very few actual memories of the pay-per-view itself. Because that was the week I was up for 3 or 4 days recording the ECW theme. And mastering the Eliminators music, both of which made their debut with the Barely Legal pay-per-view. And I also created other music that didn't get used. Like I created something for Great Sasuke, but he brought the Michinoku Pro theme. And I had a limited amount of time, like 4 days, to create the ECW theme. And, you know, plus, it was mandatory for me to be at the Terry Funk banquet. I would have loved that one extra day in the studio, but I had to be at the banquet, and I'm glad I did go. You know, so like, there's video footage of the banquet where Heyman's eyes are blood red, my eyes are blood red, Rod Buffon's eyes are blood red, Charlie Brazisi, you know, Debbie, the office staff, for lack of a better term. We weren't stoned. We just hadn't slept.
Yeah. So what was it like, though? Everybody running around doing that and whatever else. What was the feeling, though, when it was done? And you had accomplished that, though. And you guys, like you said, you hadn't slept or whatever. But was it this huge sense of accomplishment?
More than any other pay-per-view, yes. And the fact that the generator blew up 30 seconds after we went off the air.
Yeah.
Was just even more so. I mean, Tammy was doing, Sonny was calling camera cuts. Ron Buffon was running hard camera. You had Charlie was running the handheld. We had another dude on handheld. Plus, you had the Beyond Mat crew with their cameras and,
yeah,
you know, people trying not to run into each other and stalling for time and, you know, all that stuff and trying to get the matches off on time, some improvised promos that were done live. And Paul didn't have a timed out script for that first one. He just knew he had a time limit.
Yeah.
You know, so like when Todd Gordon talks about when we're almost out of time, he's running around ringside saying, go home, go home, go home, go home. And I think Raven and Terry had like five more spots, but they just rushed it into the finish with the, I think it was a schoolboy or a roll up or whatever it was, you know, like an old school wrestling finish. Funk wins the belt, goes into the audience. He's celebrating with the fans. I think Dreamer's with him, you know, and boom, we're off the air. We see the signal, the color bars come up on the monitor. We're off the air. And it was a sigh of relief.
Yeah.
Like one giant sigh of relief. And then we heard the pop. That was the generator blowing up.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you hear all this, all these folk tales of the speech Paul gave after. Were you there for that? Did you hear that?
No, the speech was before that whole, this is the dance thing.
No, no. I was talking about, I always heard that after the generator went off, he got in the ring without a mic.
And there's no footage.
Yeah, there's no footage. It was just a very raw moment. You had, you know, those that were there were part of it, and that was it.
I think RF Video, I don't know if RF Video was allowed to tape that night, but I do think footage of that exists. But
okay, he
starts off by asking people to quiet down because he had to shout. He had no voice, and we didn't,
yeah,
no working microphones.
Yeah.
And it was as honest and sincere as anything he ever did in the ring, where he basically thanked every single person in attendance, because if it wasn't for them and the support of the people, we never would have made it to pay-per-view.
Yeah. That's crazy.
You know, Heyman was known for a long time. Like most of the pay-per-views, I would drag him out there and say, go out there and thank your audience. So that became almost like a recurring theme. Whenever we do a pay-per-view at the end of the night, he would go out and say, thank you. Because he didn't appear really on any of the pay-per-views.
Yeah.
You know, he never played the role of Paulie Dangerously on any of them. And he mostly was in the gorilla position, barking orders at whoever, go do this, we need this, we need that, we need this, we need that. You know, the night itself, like I said, I remember very little of it, because while a lot of the wrestlers, they just watched the matches and did their thing. They had their match, then they got, I was running around from like 2 p.m.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, steal the motorcycle helmets. Find a store that was open with black spray paint and has we used to call him the Arms Master. He's in the video game as the Arms Master. He was like a MacGyver kind of guy. He could build anything for you and do anything. So he found a hardware store that was open, and, you know, got a flat black matte spray paint to make it look metal.
Yeah.
And he was painting over motorcycle helmets. So when you notice those three security guards with the trench coats that come out,
mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, none of their helmets matched.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to rewatch it now and key in on that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you talked about leading up to it, how much you were working on music and whatever else. So let's talk about ECW Extreme Music, right? The release. It recently just had its 25th anniversary.
Yeah.
And you got two tracks on there that you wrote, and you talk about it. The This Is Extreme, the ECW theme, and you talked about that. Is that what you're talking about working on leading up to the pay-per-view?
No, prior to the pay-per-view, there was one song.
Okay, gotcha.
That was Taz's first song, Path of Rage.
Okay.
Path of Rage came out of the ECW crossover at the Hammerstein Ballroom. At the Manhattan Center when they invaded Raw.
Yeah, right.
In February of 97. Once Heyman, that's when my nightmare began. Heyman contacted me like on a Tuesday or a Wednesday, and he told me he needed music by that Monday for a crossover. And I wasn't really watching much of the other shows. And he's like, you know how on Nitro, Diamond Dallas Page comes out to Nirvana, but it's not really Nirvana. And I'm like, no, I don't know what you mean. Well, you know how Jericho comes out to Soundgarden, but it's not Soundgarden. I'm like, dude, I really don't know what you mean. So I went to a local record store, CD store, and I bought every wrestling CD there was. There weren't that many. There was only two or three out at the time, a couple of WWF CDs and one other one. So I go back to my office. I listen to all three of them. I call them back. I said, dude, this isn't music. This is crap.
Yeah.
Is this what you want? He goes, yeah, but without the crap. And I'm like, okay, so what, I got a month? He goes, no, I need them by Monday. And I'm like, dude, you do understand that a 3-minute song takes a lot longer than 3 minutes to record. So I ended up finding, at the time, I've always been reclusive. I've always had bands, but then every so often I'll walk away for 3 to 5 years and not have anything to do with you know, being a musician.
Yeah.
That's just my own personal insanity. So at that point, in February of 97, I was no longer a musician for the time being. So I called a couple of friends up, and I lucked out where I ended up getting Steve Budgie and Richie Scarlett, who were members of the Ace Frehley band.
Mm-hmm.
I got Eddie Wall, who, if you look up his resume, he's got like 3 million Emmy Awards for music he's produced since then. He's also produced records for El Nino and Primer 55. But at the time, he had a home studio in the garage of his parents' house. So the way that schedules coordinated, you know, Paul called me Tuesday or Wednesday, maybe this Thursday. Saturday at 9 a.m., I went to Eddie's studio. I met Steve Budgie, Richie Scarlett, and this other dude, Andy Abean. And I left Eddie Wall's studio at 9 o'clock Sunday morning. I did a 24-hour recording session where we came up with 3 or 4 tunes that sounded kind of almost like, you know, that type of shit.
Yeah.
And one of them was Taz's music that night. They also played the Alice in Chains knockoff for Tommy Dreamer on the Raw broadcast. And I thought that was it. I was over and done with. But Taz really liked what I did with his song, and he wanted to start using it full time. And I said, absolutely not. There's a lot of mistakes. There's some spots that were out of tune. But when we originally recorded those, we only had a 24-hour window. And like there was one point where Richie's bass was slightly out of tune. He wanted to go back and re-record the part. I said, don't bother. There's going to be fans screaming. Announcers are going to be talking. There's going to be action happening in the ring. Nobody's going to notice. And nobody did. I noticed, but nobody else did.
Yeah.
When Taz wanted to start using it full time, I'm like, well, that makes a difference. I now have to fix it and clean it up. So I went into the studio with Roderick Cohn, the guitar player, and we kept the original drums from that session, but we had to clean up the guitars and basses. I wanted to use Richie Scarlett to redo his parts, but I call him up, tell him what's going on, and he's like, Harry, I'd love to do it, but I'm leaving for Japan tomorrow with Sebastian Bach.
Yeah,
he went out on the Sebastian Bach tour. So that's when I brought Roderick Cohn in, who I'd been working with for a while in the Slash Tones, the earlier version of the Slash Tones, and we redid the Taz tune. And I figured, okay, that's it. Now I can be a recluse again and disappear from music. And then, unfortunately, politics came into play because Taz and Perry Saturn both ran the ECW school together. If Taz had original music, Perry wanted original music too. So I got roped into doing Perry Saturn's music for the Eliminators. And as we're mastering that and preparing it for its debut of the pay-per-view is when Heyman hits me up and he says, I need a theme song to open up the pay-per-view and I need something for Sasuke and I need you to tweak the, you know, master the Tommy Dreamer thing. He gave me a bunch of shit to do, you know. And I'm like, you're giving me so little time.
Yeah.
You know, the funny thing is the Friday night as we're finishing up, because I had to leave for Philadelphia the next morning because the Terry Funk banquet was Saturday night. He calls me up and he's like, any chance you could do something for Terry Funk and Desperado? And I'm like, you're out of your fucking mind, dude. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm supposed to leave for Philly in 5 hours. And I was like, all right, I'll use the original.
Well, how did that tell me what I think, man, when I think of your work with ECW, the first thing that pops in my mind is that Sabu theme. Tell me about that.
Sabu's theme was never written for Sabu.
Really?
Sabu's theme was a concept I had for a song.
Okay.
That I just happened to record while I was also recording Taz's second theme. He wanted to change his character a little bit, so he wanted a darker version of his theme music, which we call that Survive If I Let You.
Yeah.
But originally, Perry Saturn had this idea of splitting up the Eliminators and going in separate directions, where he and Cronus would then each get their own original song, and it was supposed to be, you know, Saturn is the heel antagonizing Cronus until they finally have a match, and Cronus beats him to a bloody pulp, and Perry Saturn gets on the microphone and goes, okay, Cronus, now that you got your balls back, let's go get our fucking titles back. I'm sorry, can I curse on your podcast?
Yeah. No, you're good.
Okay, so that was the idea that Perry wanted to run with. Perry ended up going to WCW out of nowhere. You know, nobody knew it was coming. So I kept the China White drums by the band The Scorpions did China White. I like that slow, methodic plotting of the drums. I can name about 100 other songs that have a similar drum pattern. But that was in the back of my mind. And I always wanted to do a variation of March of the Monsters from the Godzilla movie, Destroy All Monsters. And I used that as an opportunity to record, you know, the methodic plotting drums with the rhythm pattern loosely based on March of the Monsters. And it wasn't meant for ECW. Then I had Arno coming in to double the guitars. Arno Hecht, the saxophone player I worked with since 94 and still work with, you know, he's toured with, like, you know, little bands like the Rolling Stones and Robert Plant and Dion and James Brown, you know, little bands.
Yeah, small guys.
You know, so Arno came in and I had the guitar chords, you know, the chart for him to follow. But as he's warming up, he starts throwing out these Middle Eastern licks. And I'm like, stop. I take away the chart and I'm like, forget everything I told you. Do that. You know, and Arno just laid down that whole Middle Eastern hybrid saxophone track. And it was just a song, you know. Originally, it was called Hookah Blues, H-O-O-K-A-H, like the water pipe, you know. And I just changed it to H-U-K-A, you know. It was easier to spell. Yeah. And Paul heard it and didn't know who to assign it to. At one point, the Dudleys wanted that. Right, they were playing. When I sent Taz's music, I included like 3 or 4 other songs that I had been working on for them to listen to. And Paul had the DJ. I wasn't at that show, but Paul had the DJ, you know, just play it over the loudspeakers. And Louis Dangerously, Lou DeAngelis, told me the story that as soon as Bubba heard that, the Hookah Blues, he's like, go ask Paul if we could have that music. You know, Bubba loved that tune. He eventually did get a version of that in TNA when TNA recycled their version of Hookah Blues that they were using for Sabu. And they recycled it to become the Bully Ray theme. But nobody really knew who to use it for, you know, at one point, you know, because it was sexy, it was mysterious, it was dark. You know, at one point, Shane Douglas's name came up, and then Heyman had the bright ideas like, we're going to have Sabu come out to it. Sabu hated it at first. He thought it was too slow.
Really?
Yeah, but then he realized he didn't have to run out to the ring and do all that crazy shit. He could take his sweet-ass time going to the ring
yeah.
and much like how Enter Sandman by Metallica wasn't written for Sandman, Hookah Blues was not written for Sabu, but that's why those two songs are perfect for those two characters.
Yep, absolutely.
You know, it just happened to be synchronous magic, whatever you want to call it, that unwittingly and unknowingly, I created the perfect theme for Sabu by not trying to create a theme for anybody. It was just an idea I had for a song.
Yeah. Yeah, man, it definitely worked because, like I said, yeah, you're right. It's perfect for him. It fits him just absolutely perfectly. And you mentioned earlier, you mentioned the video game, right? And ECW Hardcore Revolution. And you mentioned someone in it, but yeah, you're in it as well as a secret character. How did that come up?
Because they put everybody in there. I honestly didn't want to be in it. But Balls Mahoney pulled me aside. He goes, dude, just have fun. You know, it's okay. And I'm like, my thing was, I didn't think anybody that wasn't a wrestler should be in the video game.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't want to play wrestling.
Yeah.
But, you know, they convinced me to do it. So I went to Acclaim. They took all the test shots, the pictures. They recorded my voice. Now, it came time to choose moves. I wasn't a wrestler, so I didn't have a move set. However, I was very, very familiar with the game engine when it was a WWF game. I believe it was the Warzone game or the Raw's War game.
Yeah.
Whatever Acclaim's game engine was, I had picked up the game about a year earlier, so I was very familiar with the game. And for my move set, I chose the most difficult moves to counter. So I actually unwittingly became one of the most difficult characters in the game to beat.
Do I dare ask, whose moveset was it? Do you know?
Oh, it wasn't any one particular moveset. Like I chose.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
The crucifix, gotcha. Pin, the schoolboy, you know, the tree of woe, all these moves that were hard to counter. But when it came time for a finishing move, I asked them to give me the heart punch like Stan Stasiak.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have never seen my character do the heart punch because the Acclaim game was so bad. You had to push 13 buttons to do a headlock.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I was a bigger fan of the N64 games, particularly the virtual pro games from Japan.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so I would have preferred if the original ECW license, I believe, was supposed to have the Akai game engine that they ended up going with WWE for the No Mercy game and for their WrestleMania 2000 game for the N64. I forget the story behind it, but like three different video game companies had the ECW license. The first one sold it to the second one. The second one traded it to the third one. You know, it was just one of those weird hot potato things. And somehow it ended up at Acclaim.
Yeah.
And so there you have it. I'm one of the jobbers in the game that's as difficult to beat as any of the main characters.
I guess that's a feather in your cap. I guess that's something to say.
it puts me in the same category as Miss Pac-Man and Donkey Kong.
It could be worse, man. It could be worse.
I have the notoriety of saying I was in one of the worst video games ever.
Yeah, well.
But it was fun because they added the blood and the barbed wire and the crazy shit. And when Acclaim released the game, I think it was the top-selling game for two straight months because it was the first game released for mature audiences and had barbed wire.
Yeah, right, yeah.
But as far as playing the game, I went through the mode until my character popped up, and then I put the game back in a box, and I never played it again.
Yeah, well, you know, again, I think there was just something, you know, about ECW having the game, and, you know, people ate it up, and then they're like, it's wild because you mentioned the one WWE game is, which is one of the more iconic games in the world of all time, and it would have been, what if the ECW game had got that engine, how different would it have been?
And I played the Japanese version of that game that was released by All Japan.
Yeah.
Virtual Pro Wrestling 2.
Mm-hmm.
And I can honestly say that I kept my N64 console out and played virtual pro wrestling too for over 10 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you got 100 characters. The old Japan characters are as themselves, but you had to adjust the New Japan guys, the 01 guys, the FMW guys. You know, it wasn't their real names in the game. But if you move the face up one and you change the clothes, it had their moves and their poses and taunts. I love that, the N64 game. Unfortunately, my Game Shark broke, and I never bothered replacing it. But at that point, I'd been playing the game for 10 years. I haven't played it in 10 years. So maybe this Christmas, I'll give myself an N64 Game Shark and pull the game out. But then I won't have a life, because I used to play that freaking thing for like six. Not only would I play it, I would then do simulated matches.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the Create a Wrestler mode was spectacular. So I had all these little N64 memory cards with like the WCW guys, the WWE guys. And, you know, I created characters for all the extra faces in the game. I found a website that had a list of what the extra faces were supposed to be. I think one of them is like Christopher Daniels is in there. Yeah. I think there's a Raven face or something like that. So I created all those characters, and I would just rotate them in the creator mode.
Yeah. And in 2001, you did a set at CBGB's, and you played some ECW songs. Is that the only time you've ever played any of the ECW songs live?
No, we did in 98. I did one tune at an acoustic performance.
Okay.
The original version of the Slash Tones before ECW was very much a mashup comedy band. You guys could find videos on YouTube where, like, the band would play Welcome to the Jungle by Guns N' Roses, and I would sing the words to the Addams Family in the style of Axl Rose. The band would play My Generation by The Who, and I would sing the Beverly Hillbillies over it. It was a parody band. It was like a Weird Al Yankovic, Dred Zeppelin type of thing.
Yeah.
So in 98, while the ECW thing was happening, my friend and rotating bass player, even Stephen Levy, was running a club called Gaslight in Manhattan. And Sundays was a jam night where they would do acoustic jams. So for laughs, I put the original version of the Slash Tones together, whoever was still around, and we rehearsed a set of the comedy material acoustically, but we also did a horrible acoustic version of Taz's music.
Okay.
So that was the first time I did, and last time I would ever do an acoustic version of an ECW song. And then the CBGB set was all ECW songs, except for the last song, the encore, was the Beverly Hillbillies My Generation mashup.
All right.
And the punk audience seemed to appreciate that a lot more than they did Hookah Blues or Super Crazy Tune or the others. You know, for the ECW stuff, they were very respectful and appreciative of what we were doing. But when I started singing Beverly Hillbillies over My Generation, the audience loved it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, speaking of CBGBs, did you not play with Mickey Lee for a while? Joey Ramone's brother?
Yeah. Mickey Lee was in that version of the band when we played at CBGBs. I recorded the Super Crazy song and the Tommy Dreamer remake with Mickey, and he was in the Slash Tones a couple of times before ECW, on and off. He's just a really, really good friend. He's got his own thing going with Mickey Lee's Mutated Music right now.
Yeah.
But, you know, when it was time to do the Punk Magazine, the 25-year anniversary of Punk Magazine, and it was also John Holmstrom's birthday, who was the founder of Punk Magazine, was a big supporter of ECW. So when Holmstrom asked me if I could play his party, I said, shit, yeah, why not? You know, it had been 3 years roughly since that dismal acoustic performance. So I'm like, all right, this time we'll do it electric. And I put together an offshoot band where it was myself, Roderick Cohn, Arno Hecht, and Steve Budgie, which were regulars. I had Ron Randall play bass, because when We were recording the second or third version of the ECW theme. Ron was Roderick Cohn's roommate, and he heard that riff, ba-da-dum, bump-bump, like 10,000 times. And at one point, he made me promise that if I ever did that song live, I would let him play bass just so he could get that song out of his head. You know, and it only seemed right to have Mickey Lee also perform at that show because it was CBGB's and he had performed on some of the ECW tunes. You know, somewhere out there, a recording of that show exists. I have one in my archives that I haven't found in 15, 20 years. But it was actually a really, really good show, all things considered.
Yeah, I like it. Mickey's always out there, you know, keeping Joey's memory alive. You always hear him, you know, sharing stories and whatever else. And I'm a big Ramones guy, so I always like, you know, guys out there keeping that alive.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, everybody was like big on Joey, but for me, Joey was just Mickey Lee's older brother. It sounds weird, you know, because. Yeah, I mean, I had dinner at the mother's house where, you know, Joey was there with his then current girlfriend and Mickey and a few other friends. And it was just a casual thing. But,
yeah,
you know, I was never the biggest Ramones fan. I appreciated their stuff. But, you know, within that genre, I listened to The Clash and The Talking Heads.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, Ramones, I love seeing live. I saw them, I don't know, like 30 times live.
Yeah.
I think I only have two or three Ramones records.
Yeah.
You know, but Joey was just, he was Mickey's brother to me. He wasn't the famous rock god Joey Ramone. He was Mickey's, you know, he was Jeff Hyman to me.
Yep, right.
Mitchell's older brother.
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't think we can talk ECW without bringing up the Travel Lodge. And, I know it. You said anything's on, you know, anything's fair game if it's not illegal. So we may have to walk a fine line here. But what stories can you tell us from the Travel Lodge?
My first one, the first time I stayed overnight in Philadelphia, I went to an ECW show at the arena, and Paul had Debbie Beaumont call me up and say, "I'm making a reservation for you at the Travel Lodge where everybody's staying." So I get to Philly, go to the Travel Lodge, and I'm like, wow, this is like a heroin addict hotel. What the fuck? Okay, so I put I go up to the room they assigned me. There's no bed in the room. The bed is missing. Mm. So they then give me another room where there is a bed, but no sheets. And I'm like, I've slept in worse. Yeah, this'll do. Go back to... you know, go to the arena, which was a few blocks away. And when the show was over, I asked Perry Saturn, who I had met a few months earlier. He was one of the first dudes that I really got to know in ECW. And this is all, again, way before music. And I asked Perry, hey, there's so many cool clubs here in Philly. There's the Troc. There's all these clubs. Anybody doing anything after the show? And he's like, we're going back to the Travel Lodge Hotel. We're going to go hang out at the bar. I'm like, why? Because it's full of rats. Now, I'm an outsider, and I thought he meant literal rats. And I'm like, I know wrestling is strange, but what's this fascination they have with rats? Like, do they try and catch them? Is it like a contest? Is it like an act of bravery? You know, see how many rats you can catch while holding a beer? And Van Damme saw the look on my face of confusion. He comes up to me and goes, in wrestling, a rat is what musicians call a groupie.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just need a little water.
That's okay.
You can edit my cough out. So, I come from the Limelight VIP room as my background. I come from that whole hair metal, Guns N' Roses, Motley Crue, supermodel.
Mm-hmm.
Big giant hooters and scantily clad outfits. So that's what I'm expecting.
Yeah.
I walked into the bar at the Travel Lodge, and it was like walking into Mos Eisley's Cantina in Star Wars. There were creatures there, which I'm sure they were nice people, but I didn't really know if they were human or not. So I quickly had a beer. and basically went and found Van Damme's room and just hung out with him and Sabu for the next few hours up in their hotel room. Hold on, can you pause this for 1 second?
Yeah, just go ahead. Do whatever you got to do.
Sorry.
No, you're fine.
I quit smoking about 3 years ago, and since I quit smoking, I've developed a non-smoker's cough when I talk for too long.
Oh, that's all right. No, just keep going. I can edit anything out that needs to be edited out. No big deal.
All right, and I'll jump back in. I just had to do a couple of shots of NyQuil so I could keep talking. So I look around the bar, and it's like Mos Eisley's Cantina. And I said, fuck this. And I go upstairs, and I find Van Damme's room. And I hung out with him and Van Damme. Now, the Travel Lodge was fun, but I would not partake of any of the rat goings on. I had a little bit too much respect for my penis, but the debauchery that I saw going on there made me really like ECW as a company. I'm like, these fuckers are insane.
I always heard that Bill Alfonso was a little wild and partook plenty.
Everybody was. That first night, there was like somebody had to go get Ted Petty was naked and passed out in the lobby. It was just any story you tell from the Travel Lodge, people think you're lying.
But it's true.
Yeah, that's the absurd thing. I think Mustafa was having a bad trip. Like he spiked his weed or something, and he ended up lost in the basement of the Travel Lodge, and he was screaming for help, and nobody knew where the cries and the moaning was coming from. There were other women that, well, again, I'm sure they were nice person. They just weren't my type.
Mm-hmm.
That would go from room to room. And there was a crew of them that would be more than happy to service guys like Gary Albright and Dr. Death. And I'm not saying them in particular, but the guys that were doing a brief ECW run from Japan.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, like, hey, is there any woman I can get with? They'd be like, yeah, go talk to her. Just tell her you're a wrestler and you're in. The thing that it was a giant circle.
Yeah, yeah.
So you could just be walking in circles from room to room on the same floor and then go down a flight of stairs, and there'd be the debauchery going on in various rooms, and everybody's getting high and getting drunk and messing around with the girls and what have you. It was just Sodom and Gomorrah meets Caligula. But not as pretty.
Yeah. Yeah, that isn't that what they called that? What they called the cylinder of sin?
Cylinder of sin.
Yeah, yeah.
It was almost a rite of passage. I'm forgetting who, but somebody got a room that had a chalk outline on the floor because somebody had been murdered in the room the night before.
Oh man.
And the chalk outline of the body was still there. You know, for me, I checked in there a bunch of times. One time I checked in. There was no TV in the room. And I called downstairs. I'm like, just so you know, there's no TV here. And the lady's like, what did you do with it? I said, what do you mean what? I just opened the door. So they sent security up. And they said, can we see your luggage? I'm like, how the fuck am I going to put a TV in an overnight bag?
Oh, man. Oh, that's crazy. Oh, so...
What's crazy is ECW got banned from there.
Oh, no.
I mean, seriously, how fucked up of a company were we that we got banned from the Travel Lodge? That's like being banned from a crack house.
Yeah. When you're too nuts.
It wasn't the only hotel ECW got banned for life from. You know, there were a few others until we finally, I think it was the Hilton or the Sheraton, right by the Ben Franklin Bridge exit, that finally let us get blocks of room for people to stay there. And that was a much higher class area. So the boys were on their better behavior to a degree.
Yeah, dude.
but still, there was crazy shit. And of course, the smart ones, they stayed at a hotel by the airport, away from the debauchery.
Oh man. So when you when did you know that ECW was in trouble? That it was going, you know, it was done.
A few months before it was over, because Heyman had a way of pulling miracles out of his ass. And he was doing everything he could to get us on another TV deal. Now, there's a lot of misconceptions of those final months. I can tell you for a fact, he did not film Rollerball while ECW was still alive. I know that for a fact. He had tried to get us, the USA Network had lost WWF because they then went to TNN, which changed its name to something else. Mm-hmm. I think they became Sci-Fi or whatever it was.
Yeah, Spike or something, didn't they?
Spike. Yeah. Paul had a meeting with, I think the guy's name was Barry Diller from the USA Network. And I arrived to Paul's house during the week when ECW wasn't running. I would be with Heyman like 3 to 5 days a week, you know, doing stuff up at his house and what have you. So this particular day I show up, I think it was like 10 o'clock. I take his luggage. I put it in the trunk of my car. We have an hour to kill before we need to leave for the airport. He gets a phone call. The next thing I know, he's calling Debbie to get him on the next flight. Barry Diller didn't want to take the meeting. Apparently, Barry Diller had some weird, funky depression that if he couldn't have WWF, he didn't want any wrestling on his network. Hmm. So now I've got Heyman's luggage in the car, and now Paul is reaching out to every contact he had him, and he's calling Steve Carroll up from Stonecutter Media. He's trying to get a meeting with somebody in California. His flight got changed 4 or 5 times. I was there from like 10, 11 in the morning, and it wasn't until like 6 in the afternoon when I saw him hang up the phone. He looks and goes, "Do me a favor, call Debbie and tell her to cancel my flight." And he just couldn't do it. He tried to do a deal with MTV where MTV would do a reality show based on Justin McCulley breaking into the wrestling business. Mm-hmm. Justin was the UFC dude, the MMA dude. I think he ran the Inoki Dojo in California.
Yeah.
So the concept was ECW would be part of this reality show, but it would still put us on television and allow us to continue doing live events and pay-per-views. But the TV show would be based around Justin breaking into the wrestling business. And that just never happened. And he really did try to get us on another network. All the shit about him being in Vince's pocket, I don't know how true that is and how true it's not, because as I love Paul dearly, I learned a long time ago, his father's own words, if he's awake, he's lying. So any information I have that came directly from Paul Heyman may or may not be true, and the names may have been changed to protect the innocent type of shit.
Yeah.
But I was firsthand there watching the guy's veins bulging out of the side of his head as he did everything he could to try and get us back on another network. Going on TNN, the company prior to TNN was $1 million in debt, which was manageable. But because of the high cost of their production demands and this, that, and the other thing, and having to put guys under contract in 1 year, ECW, HHG Corporation, went from a $1 million debt to a $6 million debt.
Yeah.
And eventually he just realized, you know, it's the Titanic. No matter how many times you plug the hole in the side, water is still getting in.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, I still had hope. In January, after the last pay-per-view, I was there and I watched him put together an idea for the Living Dangerously pay-per-view in March of 2001 that never happened. And I remember him saying that he would get Rhino back from WWE for WWF at the time for one night. And he would put the belt on Van Damme and he would borrow some guys from Vince. And then there were some independent talents he would bring in as well and give them their start. He tried to get that March pay-per-view to happen, but then a series of events happened. Jerry Lawler's wife, Kat, gets fired from WWF.
Uh-huh.
Jerry Lawler quits in protest.
Yep.
Vince contact gets Heyman to go on TV to replace Jerry Lawler. In those first few months, Heyman was a nonstop ECW billboard with his ECW hat and the laminates, you know, and he wasn't, I don't know if he was under contract with them or not, but in the very beginning, he agreed to do that, trying to get closer to Shane McMahon because Shane wanted ECW to continue in some form.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we didn't have the technology back then like they do now where you can do internet broadcasts and pay-per-views and all that stuff. If Heyman had access to YouTube and shit like that in 2001, the company would have lived.
Yep. Yep.
You know, so it wasn't until the nail in the coffin. And even when he came out on Raw and everybody was shocked about that, you know, he still had hopes of reviving the company, but then they made him the offer he couldn't refuse. And he realized I could, you know, continue to try and plug the hole in the side of the Titanic, or I could just try and swim to shore. And he decided to swim to shore.
Yeah. I mean, you can't blame him. I mean, you know, he clearly was, you know, he was going under.
Yeah.
And, much as you love, you know, you got to self-preserve sometimes, right, and do what's best for you. And
well, yeah, I can't blame the dude. You know, you're looking at a $6 million debt.
Yeah, yeah.
And sky-high production costs plus, all the back pay and all of this and all of that. So he was looking at try and keep ECW alive and spend the next 5 years just trying to get it out of debt. We're moving on with his life, and he chose to move on. I don't think anybody would have done differently.
No. I mean, he's done pretty well for himself since. I mean, you can't knock him. Still integral.
Yeah, he was always one of those people that never looked back.
Yeah.
You know, years and years ago, he says, like, did you go to your high school prom? Yeah. Did you have fun? Yeah. Do you want to go back to your high school prom? No, I don't.
before we wrap up and close here, let's plug you a little bit. You're still working on music, right? I saw you said something about doing some Christmas tunes and stuff.
Yeah.
What's going on with all that?
I haven't done anything in a while, so I decided to do the most absurd left field thing possible. Christmas music.
There you go.
But it's not going to sound like the stuff you would hear at Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade or stuff like that. It's my take on some holiday music that was written in the 1800s.
Ah.
And it's an interesting project because this is the first project I'm using remote technology and digital technology.
Ah.
Where I created the songs, all instruments, guitar, bass, drums, you know, ukulele, all that shit on MIDI. I then send the tracks to even Stephen Levy in Manhattan. You know, I live in Queens. He lives in Manhattan. So via the internet, I send him the tracks. He plays bass. He then sends those tracks out to Las Vegas, Nevada, where an old drummer and good friend of ours, Les Warner, who at one point was the drummer for the Cult.
Yeah.
He plays drums on those. The tracks come back to Manhattan for minor mixing. Then they go to San Diego, California, where an old friend that I've never gotten to work with before, and this technology has allowed me to work with, a great guitar player named Tom Jack. Originally out of Canada, he was in a band called Jax in the 80s and 90s, and he was in a bunch of other bands up in Canada. he's another recluse that kind of steps away from music and does other things. So he's been giving me guitar tracks. Another friend that I've known since the early 90s here in New York, Ross Byron, gave me a guitar track. Those get mixed down. The next step is they go out to California again. Where Tony Morabito, who at one point went by the name Tony Moore, and he was in a band called Riot that had a bunch of records on CBS with guitar player Mark Reale, who has since passed away. Tony's going to sing on those. They come back to New York. And the only time we're going to go into an actual recording studio is for Arno to lay saxophone down. But everybody has remote recording. Everybody has their own home studios. So this was done as an experiment to see, you know, how would it go? And I am beyond happy with how the tracks are progressing. I'm about 3/4 of the way done with everything. And the game plan is to release a day or two after Thanksgiving. You know, the way Christmas used to be, where Christmas didn't start until you saw Santa Claus at the end of the Thanksgiving Day parade.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to wait until after Thanksgiving to release these songs on every streaming platform on the planet. We're putting them out on Spotify, on Apple Music. You know, okay. It'll be under the name Harry Slash and the Slash Tones. And most of the guys I mentioned also worked on ECW material. Tony Moore sang vocals on Taz's music. He sang the lead vocals on Scotty Anton's music, The Clap. Mm-hmm. Arno played saxophone on Hookah Blues and everything else that had sax, or, you know, Super Crazy's tune. Even Steven played bass on Super Crazy's tune and the song I did for Rick Rude. You know, so you got a whole bunch of the ECW musicians plus a couple of new guys that I didn't record with, like the two guitar players, Tom and Ross, who I've always wanted to work with. And then Les Warner, who was in my band in 94 and 96 before ECW, that I loved working with as a drummer, but never had the opportunity to do anything with. And if people listen to this stuff and like it, maybe I'll do 3 or 4 more tunes for next Christmas.
But yeah, never know. Maybe Harry Slash could be as synonymous with Christmas as Mariah Carey.
I hope not.
No?
For me,
okay.
Here's the way the project started. A old collaborator, female singer I worked with back in the 90s approached me about doing the Christmas songs for her.
Mm-hmm.
So once you put an idea in my head, my OCD kicks in. And within 2 weeks, I had created 5 or 6 songs for her using mostly GarageBand just to structure the tunes.
Yeah.
But then, you know, I don't want to say she flaked out, but she flaked out. And I didn't want my work to go to waste. So that's when I started making phone calls and say, hey, do you want to do a Christmas song? And people are like, what? They thought I was joking. But, you know, I look at it like this. According to Paul Heyman, the Nashville Network didn't want the ECW theme because they said it was too demonic. So this is me giving equal time to the other team.
There you go. Yeah. Balancing it out.
You know, it's as a musician, it's just a challenge because I would not listen to any pre-existing versions of the songs. What I did was I found the oldest sheet music available. I created the melody line on a digital flute and then built the tracks around the melody line as for the rhythm tracks and the backing tracks, using the flute as a stand-in for the female singer that was originally supposed to sing this stuff. The way it's coming out now is like beyond anything I could have imagined. We're doing Good King Wenceslas.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a cross between a Saturday morning cartoon and like a Saturday Night Live skit. It's just very whimsical. But then the opposite end of the spectrum is probably the darkest version of God Rest You Merry Gentlemen I think it's ever been recorded.
All right.
The music almost sounds like it should be in a horror movie. And then I have the one right in the middle, In the Bleak Midwinter. which is just like a peppy, up-tempo, 60s rockish sounding tune. For me, like I said, it was more of a challenge, musical challenge and creativity than anything else. And hopefully the good people listening to your show will go find this stuff on Spotify and maybe download it for 99 cents or whatever the price is going to be. And I hope people like it. And if they don't, it is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. So everybody can go out and hit up Harry Slash and the Slash Tones on their favorite music platform. Go ahead and follow them. Right. They're artists. I know on Spotify you got an artist page. So go ahead and follow. Turn on those notifications or whatever.
Honestly, I don't know if I have an artist page on Spotify, but I'm on Facebook, I'm on Instagram, and I'm on Twitter X or whatever it's currently called. If you look up Harry Slash, you'll probably find me.
There you go. So, but you already know it's coming the day after Thanksgiving. So go look for it.
Hopefully.
Hopefully, yeah.
You know, like I told Paul Heyman 25 years ago, a 3-minute song takes a lot longer than 3 minutes to record.
That's right. You can't rush it, right? Yeah.
But it'll be out hopefully before New Year's.
There you go. All right. Well, thanks for coming on, Harry, and talking with me. And man, I feel like we have to have you on again, because I feel like we could just talk for another 2 hours sometime. I know your voice may not like that, but
it's only now that I have all the stitches in my mouth and I sound like an 80-year-old man, but you know, thank you for having me. I think your show is called This Is Extreme, so it only made sense for me to eventually make an appearance here.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, I told you when I started doing it, I'm like, hey man, I'm borrowing your title there. I hope it's cool.
Yeah, go for it, dude.
Yeah.
Support This Is Extreme and buy the This Is Extreme shirt. Show the world that you are part of the revolution and that you support our podcast and the history of ECW. Go to tinyurl.com/ECW pod shirt and buy yours today. This is
Extreme. All right, and welcome back to This Is Extreme. I am Dave Dynasty. Thank you to Harry Slash for coming on and giving us the time and having that great interview with me. Again, we'll probably have Harry on again in the future because he's got a lot more stories to tell, and he's such a fun guy to talk to, and I hope you liked that interview as much as I did conducting it with Harry. Again, remember, subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform. Follow us on social media. We are on X, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Look up ECW Pod. You can follow me personally on Twitter at The Dave Dynasty. And the best way you can support the show is to go and buy a shirt. It's at tinyurl.com/ECW pod shirt. Go buy the This Is Extreme shirt. And remember, the Christmas season is coming. So go buy a shirt for your favorite ECW fan that you may know. We will have another great episode coming up in 2 weeks. On that episode, I have a really, really fun interview that I did with longtime ECW ring announcer Bob Ortiz. You're going to want to hear this interview. It's fun. Bob is a great, great guy, really friendly, really personable, and has a ton of stories. And he was there with ECW for the entire run and, you know, really close to Todd Gordon. So Bob was a great, great interview. So you're going to want to check that out in 2 weeks. Thank you for listening again. Thank you for subscribing and all your support. And until that episode in 2 weeks, wherever you go and whatever you do, be good, be safe, and always keep it extreme.